All right, welcome back. Good to see you. If you're new here, my name is Joel. I'm one of the leaders in the church. And we have teaching from the Bible here at Church of Christ the King every week. We've been going through a book in the New Testament called Galatians. It's a letter written by Paul. Paul was one of the people that helped to begin Christianity. He would preach the message of Jesus in one city and then move on to the next city and then the next city. And what he'd do is he'd leave behind a group of new Christians and then he would keep in touch with them by writing letters to them. And what we have are the letters that he would write, and they are still relevant to us today. These are letters that we believe he wrote under the inspiration of God the Holy Spirit. And so I want you to know that this book here has changed our lives, and it has the power to influence anybody's life, because through it, the living God is able to speak to us. He speaks to us about the thing that is most important in all the universe, and that is his son, Jesus, who we've come to know for ourselves as a real, risen from the dead person. And so Paul experienced him in the same way, and he gives us wisdom about this person through the letters that he wrote. So I'm going to read to you in just a moment the first 10 verses of chapter 1. We're only a couple of weeks into this series, and we go through these books slowly because we want to get all the juice out of them. They're worth taking slowly. So I'll read to you the first 10 verses, and then I'll pray, and then we will get into it. It says this: Paul, an apostle, not from men, nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father, who raised him from the dead, and all the brothers who are with me, to the churches of Galatia, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from the present evil age, according to the will of our God and Father, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another one, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed. As we've said before, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I was still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. Imagine if I came over to your row of where you're sitting in this room, or came to the site where you are watching this and spoke to every single person on your row to try to say something kind. Every single person, except you. You would presumably, if that happened, if I sort of literally went over and just kind of grabbed each person's hand and just said something kind and nice and, you know, thoughtful and quite specific about their personality or how nice their hair was looking or their shoes or something, and then when it came to you, I just kind of walked away. You would take it, I think, as a little bit of a slight. And you'd be right, because it would be kind of calculated. You'd feel a little insecure. What was the snub for? What have I done wrong? Well, that's worth bearing in mind when we look at the fact that of all the letters that this man Paul wrote to churches in the New Testament, the only one he doesn't start the letter off by saying nice things to them is the churches in Galatia. This one here, this letter. So the letters he writes to the church in Philippi, in Thessalonica, in Ephesus, in Corinth, in Rome, are crammed with all kinds of positive, warm words of blessing from the start of the letter. Here we seem, in fact, to get the opposite. We kind of get curse language. He starts it off with no word of thanks at all. The church in Corinth is surely the church that should get hit with curses from the start, but He can't stop going on about how nice they are. If you read 1 Corinthians chapter 1, they're the church where the rich people used to turn up for the communion service early so they could get drunk. And that's literally what was happening. That was a screwed up church. You think a church you've been to is bad? That's a bad church. Okay, you've got rich people turning up early to get hammered. And by the way, good luck getting hammered on the wine we serve in this church, because we do grape juice here. You could try it. You drink as much as you like, see if it works. But the reality of the messiness of the church in Corinth would make you think, well, they're the guys who are worthy of the cursing. No. Paul's nice about them. He lays it on. But with the Galatians, he's not got anything nice to say, which suggests that he's got something even more serious to confront in Galatia. He means business. He wants to deal with some sober issues. Some profoundly bad things have gone on right there. And the reality is, it is that serious. What's happened in Galatia, in case you've missed the last couple of weeks, I'll just bring you up to speed. What's happened is having started their relationship with Jesus, these new Christians in these new churches, with excitement, with joy, with a sense of kind of having almost just fallen in love. You know, some of you had the experience of falling in love with someone. It's like you're so excited. You cannot stop thinking about them. You just want to carry on thinking about them. And it all feels like joy and excitement and elation. And he's watched this happen to this community of churches. And since then, he's discovered that they seem to have drifted in their affections for Jesus, or at least they've slightly worn off the message that he originally preached to them. And they've started to accept the teaching of some of the other teachers. They were really false teachers. They pretended to be bringing legit Christianity. They pretended to be saying the proper, real, solid, hardcore Christianity that people ought to accept. And they come in behind Paul and they cut in. And they'd taken these people off feed and said, right, we want you to know real Christianity. We're here to sell you the real Christianity, the real solid, high level Christianity that really you ought to have got from Paul, but Paul only really gave you kind of two-thirds of the real deal. It's a bit like, say, if we baptized somebody in the church and just after they'd finished getting baptized, they walked off to the next room to put some dry clothes on, and while they're on their way, someone snuck in and just tapped them on the shoulder and said, that baptism was nice, but really you need to come to my church to get properly baptized now. That wasn't a proper baptism. Or your story was very nice, but we'd like you to know our version of Christianity so you can have the proper story. And Paul is understandably upset that this has been going on. But he's not just upset on a personal level. What I want to help you see today is that his concern for them is not just personal. His concern is weightier than that. Because he doesn't seem to tolerate it. I mean, you notice there in verse 6 and the beginning of 7, he says, I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, not that there is another one. So Paul is not accepting, even for a moment, the idea that we just kind of keep everybody happy. I think that was probably what was tempting these Christians in Galatia. They were probably thinking, well, Paul came and he introduced us to Jesus, and then these other people came, the people from Jerusalem who wanted us to keep to the Jewish rituals of food laws and circumcision and observing the Sabbath. They're really good too, so let's accept both. We can go along with Paul and these guys. Let's keep everybody happy. Let's just be very embracing to the different points of view and not rock the boat, because we don't want to offend anybody. It's a difficult time for people. Let's just kind of try and keep the whole thing steady and pleasant and tolerant. And you'd think that would be reasonable. I think that sounds reasonable. Paul isn't having it. He's not only is he saying, no, that's not real gospel, he's pretty clear about it, it's pretty exclusive, it's not even the gospel, that's wrong. He's kind of going all Lord Voldemort on them as well. You read what he says in verse 8 and 9. He says, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed. This is strong language. He's using curse language. He's like pressing the big flashing red button. I curse you. It's not even, you know, let's have a dialogue. He's just, no, this is wrong. This is really wrong. That probably makes you uncomfortable. It certainly makes me initially uncomfortable because we here in 21st century Brighton, we don't, not only do we not really go in for curses so much, and that's not, doesn't really help the conversation when someone curses someone else at the dinner table. We also struggle with the notion that there is any one particular way that we should all go. That there's one way to find God, that there is one truth, there is one almighty revelation that has authority and precedence and supremacy over all the other versions of religious truth. In fact, aren't those people who dare to suggest that their way is the only way, that their message is the only message, that their gospel is the only gospel, aren't they the dangerous ones? Aren't they the harsh ones? Aren't they the ones we should be watching out for, keeping away from our society? We shouldn't listen to such. Aren't they the ones that end up in Iraq and Syria, just causing havoc and creating death cults? And the whole problem is because of their deep conviction that they know the way of Allah or they know the way of God. Or this is the problem in society. It's people with conviction. And what we need is people with no conviction. We need a society made up of people with no certainty, with no sense of absolute truth. As long as we cut down any absolute truth claims, we'll be safe. Now, I talked a bit about this last week, and it's not the last time it'll come up because this is a big part of what this letter has to deal with. We struggle with it in our culture, in our generation, I guess, especially, because we see the fruit of what religious zeal, religious extremism can do. People howling curses at each other. They've got to be violent people, haven't they? Well, let me just say a couple of things before I move on to the next and the main point today. This is worth just tidying this up again, just to help us. And to, I guess, to be honest, to challenge the assumption that our generation makes. There's one assumption that we make, and that is that people like Paul, who wrote the Bible, they were not really aware of how dangerous religious extremism can be. The Bible was written in a pre-modern time when people were naive enough to believe that you could have strong convictions, and that was a bad, sadistic, barbaric kind of age. That was a bad time. They were awful people. They didn't understand like we do. They didn't understand that we should be tolerant and liberal and Western about things. The problem with that is that Paul actually knew better than we do how horrible religion can be. He knew better than we do. So we watch something happening involving ISIS on our TVs and our newspapers, on our news websites, and we're shocked because of the pictures. We're shocked because of the descriptions of something that happened. Paul didn't have to read about it or watch it on a screen. He was there. He did it himself. Before Paul became a Christian, that's what he was like. He was an extremist for the other side. He was, in his case, a fundamentalist religious extremist for the Jewish cause, to the point where he would literally, he goes on to say it in the next part of this letter, he would persecute Christians. In fact, there's a place that nicely summarizes it in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 6. He says, as to zeal, I was a persecutor of the church. As to righteousness under the law, blameless. That's quite a telling phrase. He's basically saying, I was considered a really good person, a blameless person. Why? Because I locked up Christians. In my culture, that was good. That was how bad it was. He's saying, he's being ironic. He's making the point, saying, look, I know what religious extremism can be like. I know. I did this stuff. Imagine it. If Paul was there when people were brutal, were tortured to give up their Christianity. He tried to force people to blaspheme against Jesus. Force them to. I can imagine him, as one of those people that would be literally turning up at someone's house at night and dragging them away from their children.
with their children, saying, don't take them, don't take them. And him saying, just carelessly pulling them away, throw them on the cart, we're taking them off, you'll never see them again. Why? Because they are Jesus people. And that doesn't fit with my religious view of the world. Take them away. This is a sinister man. He was not a nice person. He'd seen the worst. He'd done the worst. So don't let's be arrogant and imagine in our 21st century Brightonian worldview that, well, these people, they don't really know how harmful Christianity can be or how harmful religion can be. No, no. Paul knew from firsthand experience that people who claim to be speaking for God can do brutal things. But here's the difference, and this is what I really want us to see. Follow me on this. This is massively important for our generation. He understood that there are more than one option when it comes to how we deal with this problem. Religious extremism of the worst kind, in our society, we tend to deal with it by saying all religious conviction is wrong. All belief about truth is wrong and dangerous and must be suppressed. We mustn't allow it too much airtime. We mustn't. It's dangerous. We must opt instead for a kind of general, bland, vanilla-flavored paradigm of everyone's basically the same and every religion's basically the same, and let's not get too excited about it. Let's just never allow anyone to think that they're right about these things. Let's just be uncertain and vague, and we'll be safer that way. That's one option, and that's the one that we tend to go with in our society, the option of vanilla flavor, blandness. But think about it. Couldn't it be that there's another option? And that's the one that this letter's claiming. This letter's claiming that the other option is actually that there really is a God of truth. He really does have truth to share with us. And the truth he has to share with us is good. It's good enough for us to utterly commit ourselves to it zealously, as passionately as we would have committed ourselves to any other cause, and that it will be good for us. It will be good for people. It will be good for society. It will be good for churches. So he doesn't say, look, simmer down, calm down on the Christianity. It's a little dangerous to get too overexcited about it. He's saying, no, it's good to get excited. It's good to take it seriously. It's good for you. It's good for your society. It's good for your church. Because actually, rather than oppress you, what the message of Jesus does, rather than dominate and control you and lead you into bondage, what the message of Jesus does is it brings liberty, brings freedom, it brings joy and peace. The real Christianity does. The real Christianity is actually the most happy news that there's ever been. It's the most joyful, freeing, soul-satisfying, life-giving thing there's ever been. And this is why he's so cross when people trade it in for boring, bland religion. That's why he's saying a curse on people who replace the real thing with the wrong thing. Do you get the point? It's worth looking then for the real, true Christianity so that we're not being sold something that's actually fake. That's what we can see right here in this letter. And what I want to do in the second chunk of this message, the last half, is look at what is it about the true message of Jesus that should set us free from the fear of taking it seriously. Because that's what I want to urge you to do. I want to urge you to take Jesus seriously, but for your good. Not so that you get bound up, chained up, so that your life gets religious in a sinister and dull way, but so that you get set free, so that you enjoy liberty. That's the point of this whole letter. And there are three things I see in these verses I read to you about the truth that Paul has brought to this church. The first is that it's a humbling truth. It's a truth that doesn't actually put people on a pedestal. It doesn't put religious control freaks in some position of power. It's actually very humbling. And you can see that in a few ways from the verses I read to you. Verse 8 is a good example where he says, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you
a gospel contrary to the one we preached, let him be accursed. Now there's something, obviously that's still quite strong language, but don't forget what he says in the very first few words. Even if we preach a different gospel, don't listen to us. Don't listen to us. He said, even if I say it different, don't listen to me. In other words, he's not saying, only listen to me. I am your Pope. I am your authority. I am the guy. From now on, you're not allowed to listen to any other teachers. It's all going to come from me. If it doesn't come through me, it's not right. He's not saying that at all. He seems to be saying almost the reverse. He's saying, I could get it wrong, conceivably. Do not move away from the message first delivered to you, even if I bring another one. So he's humbling himself. Ultimately, it's not really about Paul. He knows that about himself. In fact, he knows that he's there serving somebody else. He says in verse 10, he says, am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I trying to please man? If I was still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. So listen, I get the impression when I read this letter, it's like watching somebody who doesn't like having to speak strong words to somebody doing it anyway because he knows it's right. Parents have to do that a lot. School teachers sometimes have to. You know, people in authority, they use discipline, they use authority to get the best result for the person in their charge, even if sometimes they do it against their own desire. The best kind of discipline is when you don't really want to do it. You love the person, but you do it because you love them. You do it out of love for them. Paul is doing that. He's here serving his master Jesus and loving the Galatians enough to speak a word of truth to them and even to speak it quite strongly. So guys, cut that out. That's bad for you. That's bad. You walk away from the true message of Jesus, the true gospel, you walk away. That's bad for you. I don't want bad things to happen to you. I don't want you to get caught up into rules and regulations and rituals and dull religion. I want you to be set free. Do not go there. Cares enough to speak strong words. I wonder if you have someone in your life who does that for you. We all need them, don't we? I need them. People who care enough to say a word we don't always want to hear. They don't like doing it. It's not because they relish the chance to have a crack at you. It's because they love you enough to put themselves out and serve you with truth. That's what he's doing. He's humbling himself. He even says very later on at the end of the letter, speaking about his own life, he says in verse 17 of chapter 6, from now on, let no one cause me trouble, for I bear on my body the marks of Jesus. He's saying, listen, I'm not in this to try and win power and popularity. Just so you know, I get beaten up for Jesus quite often. That's what he's saying. Literally, that's what was. You got beaten, you got whipped, he got rocks thrown at him, he got shipwrecked. He got terrible things happen to him. Terrible. It wasn't a comfortable life, but he was a servant of Jesus. So he's not on a power trip, this man. We don't have to think that because he believes in truth and powerful truth, he's trying to control people. No, no, no. He's trying to serve someone. He's trying to serve other people. Sometimes the best way to serve people and the best way to be humble is to do something that will actually make them think you're being arrogant. People can look at a person of conviction and say, he or she is being proud. Not necessarily. They might be, but they might not be. They might be being incredibly humble. Humble enough to speak the truth. Humble enough to stand for truth because they know truth is more important than their little fragile ego and their preference of how their life should go. Sometimes it takes tremendous humility to stand out. So let's do that stupid thing that we tend to do in our generation where we think that all truth claims are arrogant. No, 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 no. It doesn't follow. This man is being humble and standing fully in the truth. I'll give you one more proof that this is how it works. Later on in the New Testament, you get him writing another letter to the church in Philippi. I've already quoted from it. He's writing it from prison. He's chained to a guard in a dungeon. It's an unpleasant place to be writing a letter, but it's one of the happiest letters ever written. And he says in this letter, speaking about some opponents who have actually... I mean, these are rats, these people. They're Christians, they claim to be. They're preachers.
not all preachers are rats, but these ones are. They find out that Paul's in prison, and they're rivals of Paul's. They're thinking like, Paul's out of the race. Now we've got a chance to preach and build our churches, and it's our moment to shine because Paul's in prison. Yes. Instead of thinking Paul's in prison, you know, let's at least send a card. Let's at least, you know, show up in the visitor's time and, you know, encourage him, give him some grapes or something. I don't know what you do. There's, you know, surely there's some way that we could reach out to Paul. No. They're using the opportunity, the moment he's down. Chelsea are down. It's Arsenal and Spurs. It's time. That's kind of their attitude. It's like, we've got this moment to attack. This is the way he deals. Let me just read to you. This is the way he deals with it. He says, the former, verse 17, proclaimed Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. And he says this, I love this, verse 18. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. What? I don't get it. You curse these agitators in Galatia for preaching the wrong message. These guys, they're preaching the right message, but they hate you. At least curse them. No, because it's not about me. It's about the message. Do you get the point? Do you see this? Paul's whole ethos is like, I just want the gospel to go. Even if it's spoken by nutcases, even if it's spoken by people who hate me, honestly, it doesn't matter in the end. We're all sinners. Whoever preaches the gospel is broken and needy. Just preach the gospel. Preach the gospel of Jesus. Preach the good news of Jesus. Let this terrific, big, good, happy, beautiful news, truth, come out to the world. So he's not the hero of his own story. He's very clear that belongs to somebody else, that role. The second thing, just quickly, that I see about this truth. First of all, it's humbling truth, as we've said. Second of all, it's liberating truth. It's so liberating. I get that from a lot of places, but I get it all from verse 10. This might surprise you. It's the way he puts it. It says, am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I trying to please man? Am I trying to please man? Is that what you think? And why is he saying that? I reckon it's because it's pretty obvious if you look at the whole letter in context. What's going on is that the false teachers, the opponents in Galatia, what they've been saying is, well, of course Paul doesn't make you obey the Jewish rituals. Of course he doesn't make you observe the Sabbath and get circumcised and obey the food laws. He makes it easy for people. He's throwing the door wide open. Why? Because he's a needy person. He's trying to keep people happy. He's a man pleaser. He's just trying to win friends and influence people. He's a man pleaser, Paul is. He makes it easy for people because he can't bear the thought of losing out on people's respect and friendship. So he makes Christianity easy. He lowers the bar so low that anyone can become a Christian. What a weakling he is. That's what they're saying. That's what they're saying. Now, that's an interesting claim, and it does happen from time to time in different ways. People struggle, perhaps understandably, with the amazing freedom, the liberation that comes from the good news of Jesus Christ. Whenever the message of Jesus begins to prevail in society, whenever hundreds or thousands of people start to become Christians from some kind of different background where they used to be whatever, secular people or from another religion, or just ordinary Brightonian people who don't really want to follow Jesus, and then suddenly loads of them do become Christians. One of the things that happens is the Christians themselves will get a bit nervous. The religious people will get nervous. The ones who have been following Jesus for years will get nervous. There's a kind of twitch in the human heart quite often where we start to think, well, if they're going to join the church, they're going to have to behave like we do. They're going to have to look just like us. They're going to have to keep the same rules, the same rituals, the same externals.
It happens all the time. When Christianity goes from one culture to another, one nation, one ethnic group, one continent to another, you'll see it happen. When Christianity first went from European cultures to African cultures, what tended to happen was that the Europeans would start to get a bit nervous about millions of Africans becoming Christians. They would start to say, well, it's good that the Africans have Jesus. They also need to have Western methods of dress. And Western methods of hygiene, and what they need to have all these, they must have this, otherwise they're not really proper people. So we're glad that they're becoming Christians, but they need to become fully Christian, they need to become Western, just like us. We want to somehow control people to fit into exactly how we think they should be acceptable to us, and presumably acceptable to God as well, because that's basically the same thing, isn't it? If you're acceptable to me, then maybe you're acceptable to God. You can't possibly be acceptable to God and not to me, so I want you to fit in, to conform to exactly how I want you to look, behave, and talk, and all the details, all the externals, all the little details, all the rules, all the legislation. I want you to fit in culturally to my paradigm. And when thousands are swept into the church, it makes us uncomfortable on a few levels. That's exactly what's been happening here. Loads of non-Jewish people coming in to a Christianity that started with Jewish people, and the Jewish people are starting to say, yeah, but it's good that they're in, but can we just not make them a bit more Jewish? And Paul is saying, you cannot do that. You mustn't do that. You mustn't strangle them. You mustn't make them try to stick to these Old Testament rules, these external laws, these rituals. If you do that, you're actually trying to replace the good news of freedom in Jesus with an old bondage, an old chain that doesn't free the soul. It just drags it down. This is a battle. It may seem to us like a battle from 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, but I tell you, it goes on. It goes on and on for all kinds of reasons. See, religious people can be intimidating. You can become a Christian and be so happy your sins have been forgiven. You've got a new heart, a new conscience. You feel like this God who I've offended, this God who I've lived against, has not only forgiven me, but has given himself for me, sent his son Jesus to die for me. He loves me. He's kind to me. He's chosen to befriend me. I'm acceptable to God. It seems too good to be true. In all of the mess, I know myself, at least enough to know, there's a lot to be ashamed of. There's a lot to feel guilty about. And he's accepted me. I'm acceptable to God. Can anything be more amazing? It seems too good to be true. Is it true? It seems too good to be true. And a Christian steps from behind a pillar and says, well, yes, it is too good to be true. Because you obviously haven't heard the teaching that I'm about to bring to you. To be a real Christian, you need to do this as well. To be a real Christian, you need this. You need to do this. You need to keep this rule. To be a really strong Christian, to be truly holy, to be really legit, to be valid as a Christian, this is what we'd like you to do. And we'd like you to come along with us. We'd like you to be really passionate for God in the way that we are. Friends, I'm not even using made-up words. That is almost exactly word for word the kind of thing that gets said. People can intimidate us. Well-meaning people, religious people, who they're not necessarily they're not hurting us out of hatred. It's perhaps they're trying to do something for their own good. They're trying to make us look good. I don't know what they're trying to do, but whatever it is, it robs us of our joy and our liberty that Jesus bought for us through his amazing life, death, and resurrection. Jesus has done everything necessary. Jesus, through his birth as the man who is God, has lived the perfect human life. The one mediator, the one God-man who lives perfectly and is able to redeem our messed up lives. And he doesn't just say, well, I'll turn you over a new leaf. He doesn't say, okay, I'll help you. I'll give you a start. I'll forgive you for the past, but you're responsible for the future. That's not Christianity. Jesus says, no, I will take care of everything, past, present, and future. You go on my account. I've covered everything. I am your substitute, your representative. I am everything that you need. This Jesus, he doesn't come and say, I'll give you the A, B, C. He says, no, I'll give you the A to Z. I'll cover the whole thing. But we're nervous about that. Religious people get nervous about that. If you say to people, Jesus has covered it, you're free, there's nothing you can do to be acceptable to God, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. Nothing you do will ever make you acceptable to God. What might they do? That's what's going on here. These Gentiles, we've heard about them. We know what they get up to. If you say that they're free when they come to know Jesus Christ, who knows what will happen? Let's just throw in a few rules as well. We'll throw in a few rules just to make sure that they stay on the straight and narrow, to keep it regulated. If I was to plant an oak tree, what would I need? Just a little acorn. It's just a little seed, that's all it is. Really? Really, just that? Just that, really? That's not a tree. Oh yeah, it's all in there. That? Yeah. So we need to put something else in. I'll pull some branches off this old tree and throw them in too. There's a few bits of old oak tree. I'll just pull that off, pull this one off, pull this. There's a few leaves here. They're green, these leaves. Well, they'll be brown in a minute. Yeah, I know, but yeah, just pull them off and throw them in too. Throw them in with the seed, just to help it on its way. Useless. Because it looks so pathetic, doesn't it? The person that becomes a Christian, it looks so scary saying to them, your sins are forgiven. You're free. You're righteous. No, that's too much to say to a sinful person. It's too much. You can't say that to people. You've got to add a few rules. Keep them on the straight and narrow. You've got to make sure that they really are keeping themselves holy for God. And Paul wants us to know, you can't do that. You've got to trust the gospel. Got to trust the grace of God. I know it's messier. It's a problem. People who become Christians and you think, are they really walking with God? And they mess up and you feel like you've got to help them out. And it is tricky. I'm not pretending. I'm a pastor. I know. But we got to go for the real grace of God, not just clamp people down with behavior. It doesn't work. It's just like old dead branches off a tree. Let the seed grow. Give them Jesus. Teach them about Jesus. Explain to them about Jesus. Don't go back to Moses. Don't go back to the law. Don't go back to the rules. That's for another time. That's for another particular situation. Give them Jesus. That's enough. That will work. That will change their lives. It might take time, but it will work better than any of the legislation we throw in their face. It will do it. Discipline and rules are important, but they don't change hearts. They don't transform people on the inside. What transforms someone is an encounter with Jesus Christ where they wake up to the reality that, yeah, I used to be dead. I used to be full of sin. I used to be full of guilt and shame and grief. I am brand new. I'm forgiven. I'm loved. I'm accepted. I'm utterly accepted by the God and Father who has adopted me and his son, Jesus Christ. I am completely presentable to God. I'm as acceptable to God the Father. The almighty, scary, fierce, dangerous, holy God has accepted me as much as he accepts his eternal son, Jesus Christ. In fact, because he accepts his eternal son, Jesus Christ, he accepts me as well because I'm hidden in him. I'm in Christ. My life is hid with Christ in God. He loved me. He gave himself for me. You say that to put someone, for someone to, the person that gets that, the person that sees it, do you know what? They don't think, oh, fantastic, I get to go to heaven and I get to get hammered every night and sleep with whoever I want. Fantastic. You might be scared that that's what they'll do. It isn't what they'll do in reality. In the long run, it isn't. If they really get to know Jesus Christ in time, it might take time, but a heart change has happened and the desires will change. Their ambitions, their affections, their longings will change. And this leads me on to my last point. It's a humbling truth. It's a liberating truth. And it's a truth that's a person.
or a person who is a truth.
That's why he says in verse 6, I hope you noticed it, he says, I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting, and you're waiting for him to say, deserting what? My message? Deserting what? Good theology? Deserting the seminar pack that I sent you on those downloads? Or even deserting me? Me? I'm such a faithful apostle. Maybe that's what he'll do. It'll all be about you. It's me, poor old me. No. He says this, I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ. It's him. It's a person. The truth, actually, in the end, friends, is a person. The world looks for truth. The world claims to look for truth, longs for truth, wants to find answers. And then a person turns up, sent from heaven, and says to the whole world, I am the truth. I am the truth. Do you need to know truth? If you've come here today with questions and concerns, and what's life all about? Why am I even here? Why do we even exist? Why was I brought into the world? Where am I going? What's life all about? What is the truth? There must be truth. There must be a reason. There must be an answer. Jesus says, I am the truth. I am the truth. And Paul says, you're deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ. He's quite fond of that word, called. That's one of his favorite words. Called, you see it in his other letters. What does it mean to become a Christian? It means that God calls somebody, calls them. It's like he has the power just to kind of make us alive by speaking. He did that literally in one story in the Gospels. He called a dead man out of a tomb. Come forth, Lazarus. He's got the power to call us. Maybe your experience of being called up in situations has given it a negative feel. You get called to the headmaster's office. You get called by your doctor to look at some information that they've got from a scan. You get called by your parents to come and explain yourself. You get called in. Imagine getting called by God. What a prospect. Called by God. Got a report to God. The way that God has called us is in the grace of Christ. What a call. If you've been called by him, there's nothing like it. You're called to have fellowship, friendship, lightness, joy in your life. If he's called you, friends, he's called you to liberty, not to bondage, not to rules, not to regulations. He's called you to himself. He's called you to a happy friendship with a God who will never bore you. Will never in himself disappoint you. He might lead you into tough times, but he will be more than enough for you. Don't leave him for religion. Don't leave him for anything.